Anyway, thank you for someone who's trying to sing the descant as well. I'm not sure. I thought I heard the descant in there. Was that Terry? Lizzie. Don't you long for Christmas? Well, here's a question. Do your friends or family at a certain point start to ask, what do you want for Christmas? Do they do that? Yeah. Have they started already?
Yeah.
What do you want for birthday? Oh, that sort of thing, yeah. And you desperately think, well, what do I want that I don't have? Do you go through that? You know, I've got loads of socks. In which case, maybe a different question. What do you need in life? Well, I mean, is that different to what you want? I think it can be, isn't it? Yes. I want more food, I need less food. Yeah. Oh gosh, yeah. Someone was looked pointedly at just then. What do you want and what do you need? Let me tell you about Adrian Maslow. He was a psychologist and he wrote what is called the hierarchy of needs. Okay, now don't get too worried about big words, but the hierarchy of needs. There is a sort of staging of what the needs we have. He said we start with our physiological needs. We need water, we need food, that sort of thing that keep our body going. And then he said the next level up, we have safety needs, shelter. You know, we need places to shelter, don't we, away from the worst of the weather. We need to be taken care of. And then the next one up is we have belonging needs. We need to be part of a family, to have relationships. It's not good to be alone. And the Bible says that. It's not good to be alone. And next we have what he called esteem needs, the needs that help us to feel right and good about our calling or our purpose and our life. And in all this, Maslow, this psychologist, he said you can't reach one stage without going through all the others. You know, you need that first, you know, the stuff for your body, then you need all these different things. And then the goal, he said, is to be so much at home with who you are, you know, you can say, well, I won't pretend, I'm someone I'm not, I am who I am, I'm perfectly happy with it, I'm content with that. Is that fair enough? Yeah, he says, that's our goal. Yeah, and yet later, it's interesting, Maslow, years later, began to say, there may be something more. And that is when you get to the point of being psychologically healthy enough to say, I accept myself completely as I am, then you can look beyond yourself and see there's more. There's more out there. And he talked about having peak experiences. When you get to the top, you can see over the mountain. Wow, yeah. There's a whole world I didn't know existed. And that it's the same spiritually, isn't it? You sometimes have peak experiences. You go, oh gosh, you know, a moment of revelation. And Maslow studied people who had these peak experiences. And it was an awareness that there's more out there. And he wrote these words. He said, here's the problem. Psychologist saying there's a problem. My studies show that this is the one thing that is not dependent on every other level of the hierarchy of needs being met. In other words, people who have experiences of what you might call self-transcendence, looking beyond, getting more out of life, these sudden revelations, they're... Even people who aren't getting their basic needs met, haven't got enough food, haven't got enough water, haven't got the shelter, and maybe are dying, have those experiences from time to time. There's something more going on. So what's our need? What's our need? Maybe our need is to tune more into that transcendental something. You know, that something more. The Bible calls it the glory of God. The glory of God. This presence in our life that we often sort of dampen down and push behind us. I mean, have you ever had a peak experience where you have sudden, wow? Ever had one of those? Yeah, now and then. I remember hearing the story of someone who was standing in the Rocky Mountains looking at these wonderful waterfalls and the trees and everything, and he's thinking, wow, Lord, that you made that. Incredible. And you made me. And then an American came and stood beside him and went, you know, if you piped that, you could bring energy to the whole plane. Yeah, you think, oh. It ruined it for him. But it was a peak experience. I mean, if you have these experiences, do you see or sense that there's more out there? Do you see a vast nothingness, a sort of cold and empty universe? Or do you see a friendly but mysterious universe? Or do you have a sense that there is a God? And God is, maybe you have a sense that God is frightening, that he's so holy and intimidating that he freaks you out. Do you get to that point? Did you ever lay on the grass and stare at the stars? You ever done that? Yeah. Yeah, not when you're in your 70s and 80s. And you get lost in that vastness of space. Wow, hundreds, millions of stars. Sometimes we take that feeling and we apply that to God. And if we're not careful, he can become disturbing. And in the Old Testament, whenever God's glory showed up, what were people's reactions? They were afraid. They were afraid. But how does Jesus change this? And John in his prologue is working towards this. Those words we read. And by verse 14 he says, the word became flesh, became like you, and made his dwelling among us. You know, he lived among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son. There's that God's glory. Came from the Father, full of grace and truth, he became one of us. It's been grounded. It's been the frightening side of it has been taken out. In other words, in Jesus, we saw the glory that frightens people, yet he drew us to himself and warmed our hearts instead. Jesus changed their perception of God. So what do we need? Perhaps we need a clear and constant view of God's glory as Jesus showed it to us. And that's John's point. In these verses of his prologue, John moves us closer to at that time, a radical understanding. He starts by saying Jesus is word and light and life, all these big, incredible things. And now he'll ask, what difference does Jesus make? Great question. If Jesus doesn't make any difference, why did he come? He must have made a difference, mustn't he? Otherwise, why bother? And John will compare Moses with Jesus, the glory of the old with the new, and he's sort of impregnating his language with just about every term he can push in from the Old Testament. He says, verse 14, the word became flesh. And this is the first time word appears since verse 1. In the beginning was the word. And then he talks about the essence of this word. Now he says, this word became flesh. So up to now he's used the verb to be, you could say, to describe the word. The word was, the word is, light and life. The word was God. He's describing the essence. And now he changes it to become. The word not is or was, but became. He's highlighting that transformation that God went through. He became not just human, but flesh. John could have used other words, couldn't he? He could have said he became a man, or became a human being, or took on a human body. But instead, John uses the word flesh. And we kind of misunderstand what flesh means these days. Because the word in Greek is sarx. It's sometimes translated our sinful nature. But it's not just that. It means the earthiness of being human. All the problems we go through, all the struggles, all what it is to be a human being with its weaknesses. We get thirsty and hungry and weak and we struggle. And God took on not just our body, but our flesh, all that. God chose to limit himself within our weaknesses. But think for a moment, what if God has come in Jesus in some way, think what he gave up for us. He gave up that omnipresence so that he couldn't be everywhere at once in that sense. He limited himself to one gender, even when both man and woman were made in his image. He limited himself to one race, one part of history, one time span. And through history, Christians often thought we should push our flesh aside so that we can leave our filthy, earthy bodies and get to something better. But John says God values our flesh, our physicality, our lives. He wants to redeem all creation, all the problems we go through. So he enters it and becomes flesh. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. In other words, he was with us. Isn't that good? He was with us. Verse 1 says the Word was with God. Now he says the Word was with us. Notice he doesn't say people or mankind. He says us. We have seen his glory. Take note, he comes to us. We, all of us, can see his glory. And you go back a moment and John says, he made his dwelling among us. Some translations say he dwelt among us. Some say he tabernacled with us, meaning to pitch a tent. In the Old Testament, God's glory would rest upon a tent, wouldn't it? In the middle of the people. And that's this word. John's using Old Testament imagery to say, Jesus tabernacled with us, lived with us, like God did in Moses' time. And Exodus 33 says, as Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. And then in Exodus 40 says, Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Yet John says, we have seen this, his glory. It was there in the person of Jesus. It didn't scare us. Instead, we were drawn to him. So this closeness is a picture of God's glory. Not just the fire, the cloud and scary stuff when we get to the top of a mountain and go, wow, not just that. But John says, when I look at Jesus, I see God's glory, but it's not what we expected. He comes to love and befriend us. The glory of the one and only Son, or the one of a kind, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Notice that. Jesus came full of grace and truth. He'll say the Old Testament covenant, the Ten Commandments, and also came with grace. Because law was God's gift of grace for what was needed at the time. And Jesus is now the new grace, but he's grace and truth. So what does he mean? It's not as if the law was grace and lie, was it? I mean, the Old Testament law. Jesus was truth. In the sense, I suggest that he was the reality of which the Old Testament was the pointer. This is what God's like. The Old Testament pointed towards what Jesus is now the substance of. For instance, Jesus says, I'm the true bread, the true manna. He's not saying the manna God gave in the Old Testament was a lie. He's saying it was a pointer. It wasn't the whole thing. I mean, maybe you read the Old Testament and it confuses you. And, you know, I worry about people who say, well, start at Genesis and read through, because I think they get lost sometimes if they don't know the Bible. And you say, well, why did this happen? Why on earth? You know, why a talking donkey? I mean, there's some strange stories. Why does God do this? And it may be mysterious, but one thing we can say is that Jesus gives us the substance of God's heart for us. We can understand the sort of God he is. And then you work backwards and say, well, in light of that, what do we understand of that? And John, verse 15 says, John testified concerning him. See, this is John the Baptist testified. He cried out saying, this is the one I spoke about when I said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. Now, birth order was very important. Do your children sort of, have they had arguments about who's more important? I'm oldest. I should get first pick. Have they done that? It was very important in those days. Being older put you at a higher rank. You know, you weren't just older. You didn't have more jobs to do, like putting the rubbish out more. But you had a higher rank. And John the Baptist was 6 months older than Jesus. And also, John the Baptist started his ministry before Jesus. And it could look like John the Baptist was the leader and Jesus was a disciple supporting him. And here John makes it clear, Jesus might be after me, born later, but really he is older. He always existed. He has precedence. Verse 16, out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given. Or grace upon grace. Or one blessing after another. See, it can be translated many different things. The Greek is charin anti charitos. Both forms of the word charis, meaning grace. Anti is a word for comparison or verses. So grace compared to grace. And one translation puts it, we have received grace that replaces the earlier grace. Both covenants are gifts of grace needed at the time. We are now in the covenant that we need, covered by the grace that we need. But with Jesus, it's not more of the same. The new covenant will be different to the old. And verse 17 explains why. He said, the law was given through Moses, yet grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And that's fascinating to me anyway, because Moses was taking God's people out of slavery in Egypt, wasn't he? Through hard times in the wilderness, you know, they slogged through the wilderness for ages to the promised land. But Moses shows the limitations because Moses couldn't take God's people into the promised land. He could get them to there, but not in. Who took them in? Those who know their Old Testament. Who took them into the promised land? Joshua, that's right. And what, the name Joshua, what is that a version of?
Jesus.
Moses can only take you up to, but to go in you need a Joshua, a Jesus. And isn't that great? It's no accident that John says Jesus Christ here. It means Jesus or Joshua, the Messiah. In verse 18, no one has ever seen God but the one and only Son. Our earliest manuscripts say the one and only God or only begotten Son. And that ties us to verse 1 again. Who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father. That's a tree in the bosom of the Father. It's the same word used later when John talks about leaning on the chest of Jesus at the meal. He leant on the bosom of Jesus. It's the same word. Now he's saying the word was in the chest of God. Or has explained God to us. Jesus shows us who God is. And, you know, these things are so fascinating, but we can read them and think, well, what point is that to me? So what can we take from this? And I think, firstly, we should all try to study the story of Jesus as a one chapter in the story of God. And that gives the right perspective. I mean, everything in the Bible is not just about us or Jesus or Israel. It's about God. It's God's story. If we read it like that, then within God's story is the story of humanity, and within that is the story of Israel, but within that, center to it all, is the story of Jesus. Jesus lives out the story of Israel and of humanity, but he's also living out the story of God. And secondly, you know, Bible studies can be boring, can't they? But if you Bible study on a topic such as grace, it must be based more on more than just word searches. You know, if you go through and say, well, how many times is grace mentioned in the Bible? you'll get such a variety and so many ways of looking at it, you'll get lost. But John's gospel is all about grace, even though he doesn't use the grace word all the time. He never uses the word outside this prologue, but it's, you know, when you continue reading, you realize this is what grace means. This is what Jesus, what he did, what he said, that's grace. He's planted seeds at the beginning, and then he'll tell examples of how that grace works through Christ. So don't just do word searches. Instead, find examples. Say, what do I see in Jesus that shows grace? Some of his greatest parables are about the grace of God. And thirdly and finally, God no longer, you know, speaks out of intimidating glory. He speaks out of love and gentleness and the humility of Jesus. This is God's glory in its fullness. In the Old Testament, when God's glory shows up, or an angel, what's the first thing he says? It's the first thing he has to say in the Old Testament when he shows up. Do not be afraid. No, don't be afraid. They're on their knees, on their faces. But when Jesus shows up, people are drawn to him. God found a way, I suggest, through Jesus to come close without freaking us out. If the Old Testament freaks you out, look at Jesus. I mean, in Matthew 11, Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you a terrible fright. No, he doesn't. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. If we're saying Jesus is God come to us, then read that. God is humble. God is gentle. With God you will find rest. God, who could say, worship me, says, I want to come and wash your feet and serve your needs. And that's the heart of God revealed in Jesus to us. That, I think, is what John says to us. And that's his glory. Amen.